Greetings, Laurel Heights. We've got a real opportunity today to know a little bit more about our pastor. So, Paul Escamilla, Reverend Paul Escamilla, we're glad you're with us today. And I'm Wendy Holbrook, very honored to be named as pastor in residence for Laurel Heights United Methodist Church this year, which is an exciting opportunity that leads to opportunities like these conversations. So, Paul, how long have you been at Laurel Heights?
I came to Laurel Heights under appointment from the bishop and cabinet in June 2 years ago. So I'm coming up on 3 years at Laurel Heights this coming June.
And does it feel like 12 because of COVID?
Yes. COVID has, of course, turned the temporal perceptions upside down. Every day's a blur's day, as they say. So in that sense, I feel like it's fair to say at Laurel Heights, we've been through some things unlike anything I've ever shared with any other congregation I've served. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the membership would say the same, and that's probably universally said. But certainly it's been, a galvanizing experience in the very best sense of that word this year.
Well, and I know I share the sentiments of so many I've visited with that we as a community are so, so appreciative, not just of your leadership, but your compassion and your creativity. It is simply a beautiful thing to behold, not just the way you love people for who they are, but love them into the best they can be. That is an incredible gift, and we all thank you for that.
That's kind. Thank you, Wendy.
Well, let's think in terms of how did you get here? Tell us more about where you come from. What's your background?
When people ask me when I received my call to ministry, I sometimes will say it was back in the year 1952. And they say, I didn't know you were that old. And I say, well, I'm actually not. It was 1952 when my grandmother, who was steeped in Methodist theology and worldview, was attending her service in rural Oklahoma. And her custom was to invite the preacher home for Sunday dinner. Every time, whoever it was. One time it was Cecil Williams, a black Perkins School of Theology student from Dallas who'd been invited up by the little pastor of that little church to fill in for him at the pulpit in his absence. Cecil Williams preached. My grandmother invited him home for Sunday dinner. And there are photographs of Cecil Williams with my mom and her sisters and brothers hanging out together that day. One Sunday, a Mexican national who was an immigrant and studying in college and then seminary at Perkins was invited by this pastor to come and spot him in the pulpit, preach for him. My grandmother invited the Methodist preacher home for Sunday dinner. In that town, in that cultural context, both of those were vocational decisions on her part, without which I would never have existed, because at Sunday dinner, my mother was home from OU in Norman, and across the table they met, and the rest is history. That's when I received my call to ministry, my grandmother. I like to say I'm an umbilical Methodist. My father is from northern Mexico and immigrated to the States as a teenager on a college scholarship at a Methodist school in Iowa that showed an interest in him. But in the little town he came from in Mexico, north of Monterey, there was a little Methodist mission, and his family was among the several in that town that had found their way into that circle of the new Methodist mission. So he came to the States as a Methodist. My mother is from rural Oklahoma and was born and reared in the Methodist tradition. So they met in that way. They met in the church. So that's my background. My dad's a pastor, retired now, from the Southwest Texas Conference, which is now part of the Rio Texas Conference. And so I grew up a preacher's kid in that sense. My dad was with boards and agencies much of his ministry, including for a long stretch, the Board of Discipleship in Nashville. Nashville is kind of Mecca for United Methodists.
Oh, I know. I've been there. Sure.
Yeah. Board of Discipleship, the Upper Room, the United Methodist Publishing House, they're all right there. And that was my world growing up. My dad worked in those buildings. And the other part of my world was my dad, in a part of his ministry with Board of Discipleship, was to go on preaching missions. Mm-hmm. And revivals, and week-long retreats, family retreats. I would attend some of those. So, Wendy, I like to say that I grew up loving both the infrastructure of the denomination, what we sometimes call the connection, and the heart for God that was behind it, and that for which the infrastructure exists. Both the sort of God box in Nashville, where the headquarters of so much of our work, and then these revivals and renewal gatherings, my dad's preaching missions. I sense that in that way, the cross and flame, the cross being sort of the infrastructure, the lattice work, and the flame being the Holy Spirit enlivening that infrastructure. That was my life growing up.
You are deeply, deeply Methodist.
Yes.
Yes. In a beautiful way.
Right. And then, of course, the local church. And my mother comes in at that point. She was a part of that world, too, Calvary Methodist in Nashville, discovering the joy of the gospel life in community, a children's choir, youth group, helping out with children's ministries, and on and on. So really, there was such a fullness to my life with God in community from childhood. And all that just became so resonant for me as I went away to school and then thought of a vocational path.
Mm-hmm. So when was it that you said, I think this is the way for me?
Yeah. Well, Kierkegaard talks about leaps of faith. I like to talk about baby steps of faith, and I think that resonates with many people. For me, the baby step was, I think I could go to a year of seminary after college. And after that year, I think I could finish this degree. And about midway through my studies at Emory in seminary, maybe I could be a pastor. That's kind of how it was. They talk about the Israelites traveling in stages through the wilderness. I came to a vocation in stages in that sense.
That's really fascinating. So even how you described it, I envision like a flower blooming, you know, that there's that tight little bud. It's beautiful. And yet with each little bit of progression, the fullness is radiant and resonant. So that's... Yeah.
Thank you.
That's an interesting story, that process.
Process. It's all been process and is yet. The flower is still finding its way to blooming. Still. Mm-hmm. I remember a bishop telling the story, Bishop Goodson. He was asked one time, when did you receive your call to ministry? And he said, well, the first one was back in 1962 at Salisbury College in the Carolinas, and the most recent one was this morning in my devotional time. That's what we mean by call. It's always that fresh.
If we're
open to it.
Well, and it reminds me of that sense of we are perpetually being saved. It's not a one and done.
Right.
Same kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So how long have you been a pastor? How many years?
35 years this past June.
Mm-hmm. So you had to go beyond your fingers and toes to count up.
I forget because it seems like such a long, long trajectory. Mm-hmm. 35 years. It'll be 36 this coming June.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really a milestone. That's a terrific anniversary to think in terms of 35 years of growing that garden. Mm. Yeah, that garden of faith in yourself and helping others in their journey along the way. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I want you to think back. What's the bravest sermon you ever preached?
I know it. I'm trying to remember the title of it because the title was so carefully chosen and obviously easily forgotten. 20 years ago, I preached a sermon in a setting where I served in Dallas, Walnut Hill, United Methodist Church. And it was on the inclusiveness of God's love for all people, including people of non-conventional sexual orientations. At the time, that felt pretty enterprising, even risky for me in that mm-hmm. setting. Gracious, loving congregation, they knew me by then. And so that was part of the context for being able to preach that sermon there. But it was my first time from the pulpit to invite the congregation to share with me an exploration of a new a theology of human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was based on the Peter story where God says to Peter, call nothing I have made unclean. And then later Peter interpolates that with the words, God shows no partiality.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the basis for that sermon with the unforgettable title that I can't recall. That was a pretty important moment for me.
And there are those incredibly key turning points, aren't there?
Yes.
In life and in ministry when you decide, I need to take a particular stand or posture. You know, mm-hmm. I can appreciate that.
Another brave sermon for me was several years ago at St. John's in Austin. By then, again, I'd been the pastor there for some time. The congregation shares the work of the sermon. And that only happens as trust is built. And the congregation's ear helps to lift that sermon from the lips of the preacher, without which not. And so it takes time for a brave sermon to materialize, in my experience. The congregation has to say, yes, we want that sermon in a subconscious way. And then it gets delivered. That sounds very simple, but I really believe that. So in this setting, there was a mental health ministry. So proud of St. John's for their work there. Really focusing on bringing into the circle of compassion and care and affirmation those who live with mental illness and psychological trauma and struggle. And in that context, one day I shared a sermon in which I narrated a personal story of tremendous anguish for me. I call it my losing season, a year when things just went awry in my work and my relationships with the cabinet and power structures and back channel decision making left me in a very, very bereft place. Depression followed that. And so I shared that in a sermon. That word is one that can be ticklish for some people. And to own it myself and talk about how I moved toward addressing my depression with counseling and with medication for a time, that was big for me. And so, so important for the congregation to hear. I was preaching their sermon and just validating, confirming their ministry, how they understood mental health and mental illness. So that was another brave sermon for me.
Certainly. I mean, to be vulnerable is a brave act.
Right? Yeah, it really is, isn't it? And I know this to be true, and I don't always keep it in my mind, but we are drawn to those vulnerable gestures and people revealing to us their uncertainty or tentativeness and their courage to share that tentativeness. And so I try to work toward that in the ways I pastor and lead and preach and serve.
So what are things that Laurel Heights has in mind?
Oh my
in
goodness.
These next weeks?
I was waiting for you to ask. I thought
you're
you'd
welcome.
Never get there. Thank you, Wendy. What do we have in mind for this season? Well, the season begins on Ash Wednesday. And at first we thought it was going to be one more precarious challenge. How do people get their ashes on Ash Wednesday? You know, I'm not really supposed to reach out and place them on John's forehead, on your forehead, you on mine. Right. And then we realize the biblical standard for ashes is self-imposition, covering myself in dust and ashes, you know, and sackcloth and whatever. We do it as our own way of saying, I am repentant. I am penitent. I am wanting to come before God for mercy. So it's fine if we do this with the ashes, and that's our plan. We're sending home Lenten journey bags. It will have ashes in it for Ash Wednesday, and we're going to have a Zoom formatted Ash Wednesday service as well as a pre-recorded one for those who don't do Zoom quite as well. And so either way, you can be part of that day. And then through the season, we have a reflection guide that each week has some prompting questions. There are 6 stones in that bag that we're sending home, and every week you take a stone in hand and reflect on these questions with that stone in hand. It's a very tactile process. And then you place it somewhere on a table, on a desk, and 6 in a row, and they'll lead to the card I handed to John earlier that has a cross on it that we make with those same ashes on Ash Wednesday. That's the Good Friday card. We travel there week to week to week, and then on Easter that card is inverted, and on that side is our prayer wall with the Easter proclamation. Hallelujah, Christ is risen indeed.
And how wonderful that you have created ritual that people can follow during this time of separation. And maybe you've done this before, I don't know. But I think this is particularly helpful when we're at home, that whole process, as we did with the Come and See video series, of trying to instill a sense of ritual of what does it mean to worship from home? What does it mean when you're separate from your worshiping body to still be in that space personally? Mm-hmm. So I think, wow, this is just exciting to think about. Just something as simple as lining up these stones creates that sense of journey forward and through this experience. Then I would also note that you've handed me this paper that gives the week by week, and each week has an action step.
Yes.
So it's not just, okay, I'm going to sit here and reflect, and this is really great, but, oh, yeah, I gotta make the full connection of head and heart and hand.
So what if when more than was lost has been found, what if the found is that by the end of this, when the air clears, we have discovered altars in the world, not just the one down the street in the sanctuary at the altar table, but in your home, in my home, we have learned maybe just a smidgen more about how to gather, how to whisper a prayer, how to open our Bible and read that once a day or once a week or whatever, how to move stones toward Good Friday and Easter. If that were a sort of a collateral blessing of this awful time, wouldn't that be an Easter emerging from the right, Lent of this wilderness season.
And from the ashes.
And from the ashes. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I hope people are going to practice those things. It's a tactile piece. It's intergenerational. Special bags will go to families with young children so they can interact in different ways. And Laura Healy has some wonderful plans for those conversations. So those are in the homes. Those are creating altars in our homes. I imagine next you're probably going to ask me about the actual labyrinth as our symbol for the season.
Why, yes, Paul, tell me about that labyrinth.
So the labyrinth, of course, is an ancient tool that is like a maze, only different. And the way it's different is a maze sends you somewhere and you really don't know how to get out. A labyrinth is more gracious and attentive to the spiritual pilgrim and guides every step and can be trusted to lead to the center of that labyrinth and then back out into life. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are never the same when we step off of that labyrinth as we were when we stepped onto it because of that journey the labyrinth has guided us on. It's a trustable practice, ancient, and Laurel Heights will have that labyrinth set up for the entire season on site. And of course, we can't gather in droves, but you don't anyway. For a labyrinth, it's more of a solitary path and practice. So we'll have people reserve a time to come in and walk the labyrinth.
So the labyrinth will be inside?
Inside, so it's safe from weather concerns. There will be two hosts at some distance, so there's personal space, and those hosts are safe, and they're keeping you safe while you're there. The labyrinth journey will be available all through the season to kind of go with those home practices. I think that maybe at the very end of each of those weeks, it says consider
visiting the Laurel Heights Labyrinth on a Sunday during Lent.
Yeah. So the labyrinth becomes a kind of our way of saying life is more than a maze. Life is more than a maze. The psalm says, your word is a light to my feet and a lamp to my path. And I remember, was it Bishop Ann Scherer Simpson on her retirement, reflecting on that moment, and she said, in the gospel life, there are no dead ends. Coronavirus is not a dead end. Being shut up at home is not a dead end. The labyrinth reminds us that there are, in the gospel life, no dead ends.
It does make all the difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That building faith is a muscle. And that muscle memory carries you through.
Ah, right. Right.
Yeah. So there are a couple of other things I know that are coming up on the Church Horizon. We will do more of the Come and See video series.
Yes. Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. We're going to do one in March, one in April, one in May, reflective of Lent, Resurrection, and Pentecost. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout. That's happening. Your team is at work making that happen. And then we're going to do companion podcast to go with each of those videos. So a lot
Wonderful.
Of creativity. And I send this word out saying, if you think, oh, I'd like to be more a part of that in the creating and the making, well, then contact me.
Come and See Endeavor in December and January was such a springtime for the congregation's soul. It was a delightful expression of creativity and connection, of gospel testimony and faith witness, so colorful, so warm and textured. It was part of my nourishment through that season. That was manna for me during that time. And I had very little to do with it, which is so tremendously satisfying, if you know what I mean.
From one pastor to another, yes, I do.
Right, that things happen with that sort of leadership from beyond, that emerges and consolidates and then just takes something and turns it beautiful. It was deeply rewarding to see that unfold. And I'm so eager to see it again in both the worship gatherings in March, April, and May, and the three companion podcasts. Thank you, Wendy. This is a nice moment to say thank you. You are an enlivener.
We have had a great time talking with you, our pastor, Reverend Paul Escamilla, today, and look forward to all the possibilities as we take those steps one by one throughout the Lenten season and beyond, trusting there will always be the next step. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Wendy.